As we saw in that last lesson, Cain ended up murdering his brother. And after God gave him a chance to deal with his heart and he refused, we read in Genesis 4:16 that Cain went out from the presence of the Lord. It looks like he made his choice and just walked away. Yeah, he was banished, but it was definitely his choice. And as Jeff said, Cain was the first child to be born to the fallen couple, Adam and Eve. And as you look at his life, you could rightly say then, and it's important to understand this, that the very first born human was an angry, proud, jealous, lion murderer. And I'm so glad that we don't have any of those things passed on. But it does actually show us very clearly that the sin nature of Adam passed on to his descendants. And it's really interesting in that dialogue that God has with Cain. As I had to try to translate that to the Batak people, there were some interesting challenges because Cain says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" And the grammatical structure of that is like that's a bona fide question. Like Cain is asking God, you want me to babysit? Or something like that. And so I had to do like a whole dance around that and say something like, "What do you think? All I have to do is sit around and babysit my brother?" Something like that to try to get him to, you know, and it actually wasn't really a bona fide question the way the form finally happened. And the other challenge was where God said, "Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." How do you translate that, you know? I had to do all kinds of stuff to get that one across. Basically, it's saying, "You hid him, but I know that he's there," something like that. So anyway, all of this thing happening with Cain shows very clearly that the sin nature came to full maturity faster than probably any other human traits. And we know if we've had kids that that's still true today, as Jeff was saying. Now, as far as we know, Cain and his descendants didn't follow the Lord. If you're filling in blanks, follow the Lord is that first one there under Cain and his descendants. And he had many of his own descendants. That would be the second one. It won't be quite this tedious all the way through, I hope. When he went out from the presence of the Lord like that, he actually established the first city on earth in what is called the land of Nod. He was a wanderer, and that, yet he still establishes a city. Then one day, Eve has another son, Seth, who, even though he was born a sinner, he did end up following the Lord. Turn to Genesis 4 again. We're still there, and we're going to pick it up in verse 25. It says, "Adam lay with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth, saying, 'God has granted me another child in place of Abel since Cain killed him.' Seth also had a son, and he named him Enosh. At that time, men began to call on the name of the Lord." And we'll get back to that phrase in a bit. But notice, as soon as he is born, Eve says, "God has granted me another child in place of Abel." You can fill that in on your handout too. Remember, in the garden, God had promised that this deliverer was going to come and somehow crush the head of the serpent, somehow overcome Satan. And it made sense that he would come through the line of Abel, who was one who was coming to God the right way and trusted God. Both Adam and Eve seemed to have thought that that was actually the plan for Abel. But then Satan prompts Cain to kill Abel. And I think that that's actually what happened. He was trying to hinder God's plan for bringing in this deliverer. And yet God came through anyway. And he always does what he says he's going to do. Nobody, no matter how powerful, can stop him when he sets out to do something. Eve knew that this deliverer, this redeemer, was going to come through her seed. And so when Seth was born, she again saw him as a possibility. As she says, he's a replacement for Abel. And they may have already had quite a few other kids by this time. We're not really sure because the story just focuses on the key players. But notice here, about Seth, it says in verse 26, at that time men began to call on the name of the Lord. And that's a blank for you, call on the name of the Lord. This could also mean they began to proclaim the name of the Lord, that they began to identify themselves as God's people. And Seth and his descendants seemed to have followed the Lord, and they were godly as opposed to the ungodly line of Cain. And as we come to chapter 5, you end up seeing the genealogical chart play out. You see a record of 10 generations from Adam to Noah. And I'm going to read down through this. It's 8 verses. Just kind of follow along and kind of pick up a little bit of the poetic cadence that comes. This is the written account of Adam's line. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them. And when they were created, he called them man. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. You see the emphasis on that? In his own likeness, in his own image. After Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Adam lived 930 years and he died. When Seth had lived 105 years, he became the father of Enosh. And after he became the father of Enosh, Seth lived 807 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Seth lived 912 years, and then he died. And then at that point, chapter 5 continues on and gives us a written account, not of the whole world's population, but it tracks the descendants of Adam and Seth all the way down to a man named Noah. And the reason that this family line is given more emphasis than the others is because it is through this line we're going to discover that the promised deliverer is supposed to come. And you can fill that in. The promised deliverer is that one there. The reason we're having you do this is that you actually learn better if you do something yourself too. And we're hoping that these are notes that you can actually use as you come back and they spark, you know, they sort of trigger thoughts and stuff like that. So that's why we're doing it this way. At this time, though, you also notice in this chapter that people began to die. Exactly like God said that they would do. Look at the end. If you actually have your Bible open and it has any kind of paragraphs, look at the end of each paragraph in chapter 5, and you see a recurring sort of poetic phrase. It says, so-and-so lived X number of years, and then he died. Over and over again, it says that. Now, it took 930 years for Adam to die, but he still died. God had promised Adam, he said, in the day he ate the fruit of the tree, that dying process was going to start. Remember, we talked about what he was saying is, dying, you will die. And sure enough, the punishment for sin is death. It might take a super long time. But it does happen. Our God always follows through on his promises and on his judgments. And that is usually a wonderful thing that he follows through, but it can also be very scary if you're on the the other side in it. And so at the very bottom of your page, you can fill in that God always does what he says he's going to do. Chapter 6 then talks about an increase in the population on the earth. And it's pretty remarkable. It's easy to miss just how populated the earth might have been. One scholar, Donald Gray Barnhouse, says that in all probability, Adam may have seen 5 million of his own descendants on the earth before he died. 930? 930 years? Yeah. And then, you know, they have babies and they have babies. And yeah. And by the time we get to Genesis chapter 6, about 1,500 years have passed after Adam was created. And so if you go by current population growth figures, there could have been as many as 3 billion people on the earth by this time. I don't know if you've ever imagined it being that populous, but that was a long time, and people were very fruitful for a long, long time. The clock ticked very slowly on. So anyway, so let's pick this up in chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, where it starts getting into the story. It says, when men began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. So, there are two main theories as to who these sons of God were. And I'm not going to solve it for you completely, but let me just give you something to think about. Some people think that these were angels that came to cohabit with women. People who hold this view cite 2 Peter 2, verses 4 and 5, and Jude 6 as proof that they were angels. Talks about the angels leaving their first estate, and they think that that's what this is talking about. It is said by this view that Satan tried to corrupt the human race, producing a race of half men and half something else, so that this human deliverer who was to come and crush his head could not be actually born. That there would be such an incredible mutation or hybrid type of being that there would no longer be a possibility of a human deliverer coming. But there's a couple problems with that theory. One is that God created each of the species so that it could reproduce only according to its kind. And dissimilar species can't actually reproduce even if they try. It just doesn't work. Also in Matthew chapter 22 and Mark chapter 12, there's an indication that angels in heaven do not reproduce or marry. They were all created individually, every single one of them, and they're not making more of them like humans do. But some teachers say that there may have been some angels at one time that did find a way to cohabit with women and produce offspring that were not entirely human. One of the things they cite is these Nephilim that they say might have been giants that were in the land. They were like these, you know, huge humans. It could mean giant, or it could be translated men of renown, like, you know, men that had quite the achievements and reputation and all that, big warriors or something like that. So that is one of the views, that these sons of God were angels that cohabited with human women. Others teach that these sons of God were the human descendants of Seth, and that they were the sons of God, those following God, uniting with the godless line of Cain, who they were the daughters of men. And maybe, you know, Seth's people, they said, you know, at that time they began to proclaim the name of the Lord. They began to identify themselves as the people of God. And so that's a very good possibility. I go to that one. It makes a lot more sense to me because it doesn't contradict Scripture down the road. But regardless of which view you decide to hold, there are godly people on both sides of it. Two things are obvious, and I would want you to catch these two things. One, it looks like the result of this union was that the human race became more and more wicked until it was fully corrupted. That's one result. And two, it's obvious that Satan was either trying to corrupt the race morally so that God would have to destroy mankind before the deliverer could come, who would then crush Satan's head, or he wanted to corrupt them physically so that a true human deliverer, a true substitute, could not come and rescue the human race. So if you're filling in at the end, it's either morally or physically so that the deliverer would not come. That's at the bottom. So you might disagree with the view that these were human beings, and that's totally okay. Just to be fair, you can look up the arguments, but I think what you want to do if someone asks you that question is to present both sides and don't park your car in one of those parking lots, because the bottom line is we don't know what it was. But focus, as you talk to people, on the result. It was meant to be a corruption of the human race one way or the other so that we couldn't be rescued. That's what we can agree on, one way or the other. So let's look at God's warning here. In verse 3, it says, "Then the Lord said, 'My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years.'" Now, God is incredibly patient. But if we continue to refuse to listen to him, there comes a point when he does stop trying. And he just lets us go, and he ends up then needing to send judgment. And that's what happened here. His days will be 120 years. It doesn't mean that at the point of the flood, men only lived to be 120, because many lived longer than that for a time. I think his patience is what's referred to here. There's going to be about another 120 years, and it's going to do it. That's a long time to wait. Look at verse 5, where you see the reason for the warning. "The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of his heart was only evil all the time." There are a lot of superlative type of statements there. Only evil all the time. Can you imagine that? We often think that our world is like super corrupted, and yeah, it is. But where everybody's thoughts are only evil all the time, we're not there yet. Maybe that's why the earth is still existing. I don't know. But I do know that God is very patient. We haven't reached this level of wickedness. And so the reason for the warning in your notes there is wickedness, or complete wickedness, something like that. In verse 6, it tells us how God felt about the situation. Remember, we talked about God having having emotions. Verse 6, "The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain." So much for God just being an aloof being. He really was grieved over this wickedness, and probably because he knew what he was going to have to do about it and to preserve the universe. It's not, though, that God was sorry that he made the decision to make humans. that never comes up in Scripture, but I think it was about how his decision was bringing him sorrow, which he knew that it would do, but for the sake of having a real relationship with human beings, he created us with that capacity to rebel against him, and that brought him sorrow because of that wickedness that he saw. So God's feelings in view of the wickedness, he was grieved. That's where what your notes should say. The thing that really strikes me here is that the God who created our world and the universe is not some cold, aloof, mechanical being that is just like he made everything. He just sort of spun the top and then walked away and went on to his next project. That's actually deism believes that God started it and then had nothing to do with it after that. The tribal people we worked with had a view similar to that kind of a deistic view. But the Bible shows us very clearly that our God is a being who has real feelings, just as you and I do, that he is engaged in human history, that he is very much aware of every single thing that goes on in this world. There's one scripture that we can't say yet that talks about him even knowing every hair that's on your head or that's not on your head. He can rejoice in his creation, and he can be grieved by his creation. And it's comforting here to know that when God did decide to destroy the world, many people will get on his case for this and say, if that's the kind of God that you're talking about, I don't want to have anything to do with him. They forget that he gave him 120 years. They forget that he continued to go after Cain. They forget that he pursued Adam and Eve in the garden to bring reconciliation. That is his first move, is to always go for reconciliation until it comes to a point where it's just futile and it's not going to happen and human hearts have been hardened to the point where they're never going to turn. And then at that point, when he does judge, it actually is a mercy to those people, because the Bible talks about people storing up wrath as they continue to sin. And so by God cutting a life short that is going to do nothing but continue to sin, as he foresees that coming, it's a great mercy when he stops that life short, because the punishment would be even more severe down the road. So just try to remember that when you look at God's judgments. He's very patient, and it's a very last resort kind of a thing. And when he does decide here to destroy the world, it's not out of anger or some blow-up that he has on his heavenly throne, some kind of royal temper tantrum, like, okay, that's it, I've had it, and then he just loses it and starts nuking everything. That's not it. He did this out of grief and out of necessity in order to preserve the human race so that the promised deliverer could eventually come and rescue us. Well, Satan wanted to stop God's plans to send the deliverer, but you know what? Neither Satan's plans nor human wickedness can thwart the purposes or the promises of God. You just cannot do it. And verse 7, I want to look at God's plan in view of this human wickedness. Are you tracking with me in your notes? Verse 7. So, the Lord said, I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, men and animals, creatures that move along the ground, and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them. Here God plans to actually wipe out the race that he created. Remember all of the things that, you know, Jeff and I were telling you about, like how much he loves human beings and wants to have the relationship and all of that. And here he's having to wipe them off the face of the earth. So God's plan on your point, I think it's point C, is to wipe out humans. That's pretty radical, but it is fully justified because of the total corruption of the race. Remember, every inclination of their thoughts was only evil all the time, is what it said. But here in verses 8 to 10, you see what God actually meant and how it plays out for him wiping out mankind. In the middle of all of his wickedness, you see that Noah finds favor in the eyes of the Lord. Now, you have to understand that God had made a promise to send a deliverer through the woman. If he wiped out every single human being on the planet, he would be breaking a promise. So what he does is he finds a way to deal with the situation and still keep on track with his promise. Verse 8, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. You could say either favor or grace, some of your translations. That's the point, Roman numeral 4 there, finds favor in the eyes of the Lord. Verse 9, this is the account of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Here you see one single family set aside, singled out. One family of the millions that are there that was still following the Lord. They were still sinners, which becomes very obvious later, but they walked with God. And right here, when it says Noah was a righteous man, it's defined by the fact that he was blameless among the people of his time. It is not saying that he was sinlessly perfect, sinlessly righteous, but that he was blameless. A person who is blameless is one who, when they do something wrong, they get it right. It's not that they never do anything wrong. There is no human that actually does that, that's ever been born of man. So they were still sinners. It becomes very obvious later, but it says God doesn't really save him because of his righteousness. He wasn't saved by his works. It was by God's grace. The first thing it says is Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So that point A would be, wasn't saved by his works. It was by God's grace. He found favor. He didn't earn it. He was, just like you and me, a sinner, but he was saved by God's grace and God's grace alone. In the Bible, grace is what we would call unmerited favor. I like to call it unmerited, demerited favor. It's like when you already deserve something completely the opposite, like total judgment, God sheds a blessing on you and favors you with his grace. So, another interesting thing it says about Noah here is that he walked with God. Now, from what we know so far in the story, that probably means that he was coming to God the right way, with the right attitude, the right sacrifices, and finding grace. But if you're filling in the blanks, don't take all of my sidetrack there. Coming to God the right way and with the right sacrifices and finding grace in God's eyes. All of this in the middle of a totally degenerate race of human beings. He and his family were the only ones that were coming to God this way on the face of the earth. The only ones. Sometimes, you know, we think it's almost impossible to walk with God in our day and age. We have this barrage of wrong information and wickedness in speeches and in images that we see, and commercials in the middle of the day. There's just corruption everywhere, and sometimes you kind of think, wow, how can I even walk with God? You know, sometimes you think that because everybody's abandoned the knowledge of God that you just got no hope of hanging on to it. But the world has not yet become as bad as it was in the days of Noah, and he walked with God. It is always possible to walk with God. In Noah's day, every inclination of their hearts was only evil continually. Always possible to walk with God. So, next, we need to move along. Verses 11 to 16. God comes to Noah, and Noah is told to build an ark. Verses 11 to 16. I'm just going to read through it without comment, and then we'll kind of walk through it. Now, the earth was corrupt in God's sight and full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways. So God said to Noah, I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. So make yourself an ark of cypress wood. Make rooms in it and coat it with pitch inside and out. This is how you are to build it. The ark is to be 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. Make a roof for it and finish the ark to within 18 inches of the top. Put a door in the side of the ark and make lower, middle, and upper decks. Now, I used to think that people of Noah's time would have mocked him. And probably in some of the Bible stories that you've heard, people were laughing at him, making fun of him, and all of that. Because I always pictured Noah living on a plain somewhere out in the desert, far away from water and having never even seen a boat before. And that's kind of the picture that you get with some of the Noah's Ark stories. Or some of us might wonder, well, how could he possibly know how to make a boat that would float? Surely, primitive man couldn't possibly come up with something like that. But you know, there are some ancient clay cuneiform tablets where they just kind of made imprints into the clay that they've discovered. And it shows that at the dawn of history, that the Babylonians did have travel by water. They did actually do that. They traveled by river. Some boats were made of skins or reeds and were designed to kind of sail through the marshes or along the riverbank. They used them for fishing and hunting, but they usually would only be like 10 foot or so long, not very big at all, just little fishing boats. Now, the other thing that comes in here is where Noah was situated. Noah's home, according to Babylonian tradition anyway, his home was at Pharah, the north end of the Euphrates River in what is now Iraq. And it was about 70 miles away probably from the site where the Garden of Eden once was. So boat building and river traffic may have been familiar to Noah even from his childhood. And we don't have a whole lot of data on that, but what we do have makes us think, okay, maybe that wasn't as weird as we think that it is. So it's not the building site that is amazing or the fact that it was a boat, but it's the size of this boat that is really amazing. Its dimensions are listed in the Bible there, 450 feet long, 1.5 football fields. That's pretty big. 75 feet wide, 45 feet tall. This is a huge thing without a skill saw and power tools. It had three different levels, so it wasn't just a shell. It was like a full little city, kind of almost, and it had a roof on it. The dimensions of the ark are evidence of the accuracy of the scriptures. Ancient mythologies also have accounts of dimensions of the ark, but they aren't nearly as realistic as this. The account in those cuneiform tablets is almost funny. That said that the ark was shaped like a 6 or 7 story cube that was about 262 feet in every way. So that one would have just like bobbed and kind of spun around in circles like a big old ice cube or something like that. So even if they brought a lot of lunch supplies, they probably lose it all the time. But anyway, there's a Greek legend, according to a guy named Berossus, who said that the ark was 3,000 feet long and 1,200 feet wide. 3,000 feet. That's like from the edge of this property to Orchid Burger. That is huge. And 1,200 feet wide. So just this huge flat rectangle. That's just, it'd be like a floating island, kind of. Which, you know, maybe it would work. But in contrast to the myths that we have recorded, the dimensions written in the Bible are similar to the proportions of some of our modern ocean liners. Ocean liners are about 8-to-1 ratio, length to width. Tankers are about 7-to-1. They're slower, but they have a lot more capacity because of that. And the figures given in Genesis give us a vessel that would probably be about a ratio of 6-to-1 length to width, much like the ship the Great Britain that was designed in 1844. It would have been a very slow vessel, but very stable. Actually, there isn't even a rudder or a sail mentioned. So they would probably have been completely dependent on God for wherever they landed. Once he put them in the ark, it was completely up to him where they end up. And we'll get back to that principle later. But many people have also wondered how you could possibly fit all of the animals in the ark, especially the dinosaurs. Well, think about this. The ark would have had approximately 1.4 million cubic feet in its carrying capacity. That would be the equivalent of about 522 standard railroad livestock cars. 522 of them. Got a picture in your mind how big that is? That many railroad cars would hold 125,000 sheep. So the ark could have easily fit all of the kinds of animals. Henry Morris from the Institute for Creation Research said that there were probably about 72,000 animals taken aboard the ark. Noah was supposed to take two of every kind, not necessarily two of every variation of every kind, like two dogs. Not two poodles and two chihuahuas and two this and that. It was two dogs. And this would also mean that he took dinosaurs onto the ark, but it doesn't say that Noah took adults. That'd be a little tough. Where do they put their heads? He was to take also, besides the two, seven of every kind of clean animal. And this is almost definitely just for sacrifice. This is how we know that Noah was making the right kind of sacrifices, coming to God the right way as he walked with God, because they didn't eat animals at this point yet. That's what the clean animals were for to begin with. So that's a little bit of background on the story, and some of that, you know, is of course speculation because none of us were there, but that's kind of the data that we have. And the historical significance of the story is important because it really did happen, even if Chuck Todd says it's a fairy tale. Did any of you see that, him talking about that? Okay. I don't know why I said that. Yeah, I do, because it stuck in my craw. But anyway, even though the historical significance of the story is very interesting and important in understanding the early history of the earth, the real significance is seen when you look at precisely how God chose to save Noah and his family. He saved them, we already know, by grace, not works, if you're filling in. He found grace in the eyes of the Lord. It had to be, secondly, God's plan, not man's. We've already seen that Adam and Eve's way of covering their shame didn't work for them or for God, and that Cain's way didn't work either. He was rejected and his offering was rejected. It always has to be God's plan, because only he knows what it takes to deal fully with sin and still save the one who commits the sin. We also notice here that there was only one ark. Only one ark. God didn't say, figure it out on your own and you'll be saved by the flood. Climb up on a really, really high mountain and that'll buy you about 38 days. He didn't do that. He didn't say, however you want to save yourself, just figure that out and go do that. And if you're sincere, it will work. He didn't say, it doesn't matter which road you take, all roads will lead to salvation. No, there was only one ark that was safe from judgment. Also, this is a huge vessel, right? But there's something very unusual about it. How many doors does the ark have? Only one door on the ark. You can fill that in. Only one way to be saved for everyone on the face of the earth. One way. It's also important to see that God himself closed the door. There was perfect and complete security for those who had come the right way and were inside, and no way for those left outside to avoid God's wrath. One way. Sound familiar? Next, so God himself closed the door, if you're filling that in. The next one is the ark took the beating for those inside. God's plan of salvation provided full protection from his wrath. As the storm and the waves beat up against the ark, there was wood and there was pitch that protected them from that. The ark took the beating. Kind of log that in your head, and we'll get back to that in a few weeks. Next point, I think it's G. Everyone who didn't come God's way was punished. God only provided one way, and he gave people probably anywhere from 80 to even 120 years to, as the ark was being built. We don't know exactly how long it took, but he gave them that much time to respond to him. But they refused, and they were rejected like Cain was, because there was only one way offered, just as there was only one way for Cain, just as there was only one way for Adam and Eve. But the good news is that everyone, and this is the next point, everyone who did come God's way was fully accepted and truly safe. And we learn here that when God designs a plan for our rescue, hey, it really works. Only he knows, and we'll repeat this, what it takes in his justice system to save us from the penalty of our sins without and get us back into a relationship with him. He closed the door. He secured them in it. And then the salvation package that he created, the big box that they were in, took the wrath that would have, the judgment that would have come upon them. God's provision took care of that wrath. It still happened. The wrath came down, but they were safe because they came God's way. All right. Well, thank you again for your patience. We'll be back here next week and we'll continue. We'll start getting into the story of Abraham and some very interesting stuff that starts to develop in the big story. So,